You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello out there in podcast land. I know that you're sitting back thinking to yourself, why am I listening to this podcast? Well, the reason why you are is because you're in love. You're in love with the words, you're in love with the passion, you're in love with the audio gesticulation coming from...
Kevin, what are you doing?
What I am doing is preparing our crowd, our wonderful listeners out there, for the most delicious, luscious audio stimulation they're going to experience this evening.
But you shouldn't be asking them why are they listening to the podcast.
Yeah, and could you please, Kevin, could you please put a shirt on at least?
I am wearing my shirt.
No, an ascot tied around your neck is not a shirt, Kevin.
I kind of figured...
These are false accusations.
The dulcet tones of this are appealing. However, put a shirt on.
Yes, and let's get to it. We are here today to podcast about...
False accusations, apparently.
No, we're not false accusations. We're going to be talking about one of the greatest...
Brett Kavanaugh!
No, we're going to be talking about one of the greatest... The greatest fantasy comic book companies to ever exist on the printed page.
Are you sure about that?
Yes, I'm sure. We're going to be talking about CrossGen Comics. Am I right?
I don't know if many people have heard of them.
I mean, that's what my notes are. And I'll tell you what, as far as fantasy comics go, this is their specialty, and this is a great comic company, and we're glad we can bring it to you.
Yes, yeah. A very short but very sweet history.
Yeah, it was actually founded in 1998 in Tampa, Florida. Now, what sets this company apart from a lot of the other independent companies that we've heard of and talked about in the past? Like, let's say, for example, Eclipse Comics or Pacific or something like that.
Epic.
Even Epic in a way, is that they had a millionaire entrepreneur backing them. And we're talking about Mark Lisi. He was the founder of CrossGen Comics, which was founded in 1998 in Tampa, Florida. Again, that is the nuts and bolts of it, but the whole thing that kind of set them apart was the fact that many of the people that they hired, their writers and artists, were full-time employees who worked out of an office. Now, that was complete with health care and steady salaries, which if
that's
you...
That's unusual.
Right. If you are an independent artist in an independent world like comic books...
You're freelancing.
Yeah, it's freelance all the way. So to have a steady paycheck, and not only that, but health care, was insane.
But my question I would want to ask, though, is like, was this just like pitched, or were they actually making progress on the comics, or was this just pitched to the millionaire guy and they basically started under full financing?
From what I know, they started out being being basically fully financed.
He had
the money. He had the backing of himself, of what he had in his accounts, to make sure that everybody was taken care of. So right away, you know, he started off doing that. And the reason why, which is there's a method to his madness, it was to attract more high talent, high profile talent, which would include, like, for example, Barbara Kessel, who became the director of creative development. Also brought in head writers Ron Mars and...
Green Lantern.
Yes, and Mark freaking Waid, everybody. And if no one knows who Mark Waid is at this point in time, do your goddamn research. Mark Waid's amazing.
You know, this has like a little reference mentioning how he was providing benefits, similar to, since you're a big wrestling fan, Darren, the AEW provides benefits to their wrestlers, and also use that as a way to attract talent from the WWE.
Well, it's something, it's an elephant in the room that, you know, you're going to have an issue where you always want to do something different than the competition, and mm-hmm. that those little things that will separate you apart from that. I mean, this is very key stuff. It's obvious, but you'd be surprised how many people will not capitalize.
It's true.
Right.
By the way, didn't Perot Systems give some financial backing as well at some point?
Who?
Perot Systems.
Perot Systems?
Yeah, Perot Systems.
Into this?
Yeah. I thought they did.
As in Ross Perot?
Yeah, as in Ross Perot.
It's possible. I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
I thought they did.
Well, did they? Did you find that out?
I did at some point.
This is a source of information.
Apparently it is.
Okay, then. So what Kevin is saying is Ross Perot donated his company donated to this or helped finance, not donated, but they helped finance part of this company to help keep them, I guess, going, help keep them afloat, help keep them running. Their first comic was a preview book called Cross Genesis, which came out in January of 2000.
Oh, wow.
6 months later, publication started in earnest with Sci-Fi's series Sigil. Now, Darren, you have a little bit on that, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's a kind of its own universe. Like they call them the Sigil Bearer, basically. So you'll have a whole, this whole Sigil universe does encompass a variety of books. Now,
it was like a unified universe, so the Sigilverse?
More or less, yeah. I mean, you know, and to spare you all the details, that's basically it. And what you have is you have a top notch book, clearly their most popular book if you just look at sales and just legacy. That of course would be Sojourn. Now Sojourn, for those of you out there, was created by Mark Alesi and Gina Villa. That's a key name you're gonna have to remember. It's essentially that the whole story is about Arwen and Gareth, and basically, like, you're talking about, like, this is a cool story. We're talking about dragons, trolls, magic, and essentially, the whole story revolves around them looking for 5 shards.
Wait, are we talking cave trolls, bridge trolls, or internet trolls?
Well, internet trolls were not quite popular yet. They did not capitalize on that.
I got you.
But those who did capitalize on that have basically ruined social media.
That's true.
So essentially what you're doing is you're looking for 5 shards of the magic arrow of Aiden, and or Aiden, depending on, you know, if you're into that, what your pronunciation is of it. And the whole purpose of finding this is kind of like the Triforce, right? You know, for you Zelda fans out there.
Zelda, Triforce. Triforce of knowledge, Triforce of wisdom.
Yeah, you're trying
Triforce of power.
Yes, Triforce of power.
Yeah, you're basically finding pieces of, you know, this essentially this magic arrow to defeat Mordath. Now, Mordath is awesome. For my money, as far as cross-gen goes, this is the ultimate villain. He's a real lanky, kind of goofy-looking guy. But
is he green?
He's like the Slender Man? Like the Slender Man?
More or less, but he's not green or yellow.
Damn it!
For that matter. Oh. But
well, they really dropped the ball, didn't they?
But his first appearance is in this, Mordath, and basically he is the enemy. He's the sigil bearer of this world. Keeps coming up, you know, the sigil bearer. And the arrow of Aiden, of course, is the only thing that can kill him. He's essentially immortal. Killing him is basically just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's just not a realistic thing. But regardless, this book is their most popular, and essentially, it had 35 issues, and it ran most of the life of their publication, being like, you know, their publications, a lot of them came out between 2001 and 2004, and that's kind of, you know, this thing actually lasted until the company collapsed.
Yes. Real quick, the Sigilverse, those are specific characters in each series that were designed to supernaturally powered sigil bearers, is what they called them, I believe. So that's a really cool aspect that you don't see in a lot of other comics. You don't see the Justice League doing something like that. You don't see the Avengers doing something like that. But they had a very public goal of competing directly with Disney and Marvel, basically by doing what we would call counter-programming. So like that, let's say you have a big tentpole movie scheduled to come out around Christmas time, and let's say it's an action film or something. Counter-programming would be to do a very independent, very small romantic comedy, basically, because it's counter-programming. It's specifically the exact opposite of what other people would be going for. So let's say there's fans of, they don't want to see an action film around Christmas time. They want to be a little romantic or have a little humor. Then they can go to the counter-programming, which would be the romantic comedy. That's what they wanted CrossGen to be. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I actually have a quiz question for you guys, since we kind of came up working together at a movie theater when a specific Star Wars Episode 3 came out.
The Revenge of the Sith.
Yes. Do you remember what the counter-programming movie was?
I think it was like a women's movie, wasn't it? Or maybe like a comedy?
A women's movie?
Like a rom-com?
Okay, it was. But it's kind of a comedy drama.
Hope Floats.
Not Hope Floats. Hope Floats was 2003 or 2001. But this is interesting. If you guys could get
Let's see. I should know this. I should know this.
The Boathouse.
Who was in the movie?
Eric Bana.
Ah. Wait.
Eric Bana was in a comedy?
Yeah.
He's in rom-com.
Comedy. Yeah. Drama.
See, this would be after Troy and the Hope movie that you don't like very much, that I do a little bit. Dangly.
I think the podcast audience is getting bored. What's your guess?
I don't know. I got nothing.
Lucky Numbers.
That's right. Lucky Numbers.
Lucky Numbers?
Took in $1.9 million opening weekend.
Oh, good Lord. Well, hey, what can you do when you go and get some movie that's going to gross $107 million?
It's not like a great counter-programming film like Black Christmas.
Which, by the way, is a remake.
Mm-hmm.
That it is. Anyway, please continue.
That's okay. We'll do. So what they did was very, 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 very clever. CrossGen did something that that no other company was doing. They had a Comics on the Web initiative, which was an early foray into digital publishing.
Mm.
It basically put the entire CrossGen library online and made it accessible through a subscription service. And then another... kind of a sidestep that they did that DC and Marvel wasn't doing is that they put cross-gen comics in the hands of new readers. They had a cross-gen education program, which brought their comics into the classroom to help teach reading comprehension. Genius idea. Because let me tell you something. When I was 8 years old was when I was introduced into comic books. Mm-hmm. Like, and my reading, I was failing. I wasn't reading at a level I should have been. In other words, I wasn't failing school, but I was just failing myself, so to speak.
And comics helped you, didn't it?
Comics helped me tremendously.
I tell people this all the time. You know, it really helps out with your vocabulary. Like, I increase my vocabulary just by reading comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll tell you what, when you mention this is a question I've been meaning to ask you guys, but I wanted to wait for the right podcast to do it.
Sure.
And I think you guys have the perfect expertise to answer this question, and that would be this. What are your feelings about people who maybe don't want to print comics, you know, off the press, and just do purely digital drawn comics?
Because
I know this movement was picking up steam a couple years ago, but I don't think it really took off. I'm just feeling, what are your feelings about reading digital comics?
You know, I feel it's no different in some respects than people use Kindle to read a book and whatnot. I mean, it's to each their own. I know personally, I prefer the traditional paper. You know, yeah. How do you feel?
Okay. So here's what I think. To each his own. Whatever people prefer. If you think that putting your book out digitally is the way to go, in 30 years, people might not remember you. That's where my problem is with that, because there's no collectability there. From a collectible standpoint, you have ostracized yourself from that whole division, which is a rabid fan base. So why on earth would you do that unless you're just thinking of wanting to get your work out, get noticed, and then maybe get hired on to do something else? And if that's the case,
that's one thing.
Bravo, my hat's off to you. But I will say, digitally speaking, I have grown fond of taking my tablet on a plane with preloaded stories, like trade paperbacks, 5 or 6. I used to carry them in my book bag.
The trade paperbacks and whatnot.
It's heavy. I just carry my tablet now, and boom, I can read them all. They've got, it's got a the way you can read it, you just push a little button on the tablet and it goes to the next panel, it brings it over, it brings the action to you. It's really quite cool, actually. And I very much enjoy that. But when I'm home, I don't want to do that. That's a travel thing for me. It's different for everybody, you know, other people. So I say whatever gets people to read and whatever gets them into comics, that's grand. But if you're going to do the digital, just know that you are ostracizing yourself from the collectible standpoint.
Well obviously, I think that there's some information here that can be assumed. We obviously want to encourage people to read as much as we can. And, you know, I mean, of course, as I often like to say, I try not to brag much, but we are actual readers and collectors of comic books. Obviously, there's a few great unboxings that we've put up over the past few months. I mean, I'm just kind of looking here with great salivation of some of the things we do. And you know what? We may have actually got a few of these books at a specific comic book shop.
Oh, sorry to interrupt, everyone. Just wanted to mention real quick about a shop in Canoga Park, California called Spiro's Heroes. Elliot, the proprietor of the store, has over 300,000 books in what's called the Temple of Comics. That's Spiro Heroes in Canoga Park, spirosheroes.com.
And we're back!
Oh, it's so wonderful to hear the words of that commercial.
So many comic books, so little time. And speaking of so little time, CrossGen really didn't have a lot of time. We're actually quite quickly winding down. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but they first developed in 1998, and by 2003-2004, they were not doing well at all. In 2003, actually. But before we get to that, Code 6. Code 6, now basically CrossGen decided that they were going to do 11 wholly owned subsidiary companies, which represents its broad-based entertainment products and offerings. They were to act independently of CrossGen Entertainment and functioning as interior businesses, all with different goals. One of those was Code 6. Code 6 was another imprint of CrossGen Entertainment, though, which was created to publish titles set outside of the Sigilverse, which is what we were originally talking about. Stories such as The Red Star, Demon Wars, and The Crossovers. All titles published with the Code 6 logo would be owned by both the creator and CrossGen Entertainment, with a majority of ownership resting with CrossGen Entertainment. CrossGen would pay an upfront page rate, then split all rights and revenues 75-25. Code 6 was a police, Florida police signal code for an escape prisoner.
You know, what's funny. It's just
funny.
I used to work at a theme park that I will not call out by name.
Remain
right now.
Unnamed, yes.
But the thing is that it's funny when you mention Code 6. And look, I'm not that clever, so I'm not referencing any of the books in the Code 6. But do you know what Code 6 meant at our amusement park?
Tell me.
Vomit.
That's disturbing.
Well, if you've read some of these books in their Code 6 universe, it's not much different.
Like I said, I'm not that clever. Yeah. I don't like to insult these artists, and the reason I can't do what they do.
I'm not saying it's the artist. don't get me wrong. One or two here, not bad at all.
Sure.
But there's you know, there's a couple here, or one at least I wouldn't. Anyway, moving on. Another one of their, besides their going back to their comics on the web, the subscription thing, the online library was estimated to contain 160 issues at its height.
Jeez.
And 4,400 pages by the end of 2002.
Hmm.
CrossGen was among the first comic companies, of course, to publish online. Now, all of this, they kind of went out on a limb, so to speak, with a lot of things. And Kevin, I think you're going to pick up here, right?
Yes. as I was talking about Perot earlier, Alessi sold his company to Perot Systems for $44 million in stock. And unfortunately, around that time...
That's right. Okay. I forgot about
in
that.
In early 2000, around 2003, there was an unfortunate situation. Perot Systems was caught and implicated in an energy manipulation scheme.
Mm-hmm.
So when you know, you remind you of Enron, like a couple years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what happened?
Stocks tanked.
Stocks tanked. And unfortunately... Alessi's money was drying up because, you know, that's where a lot of his money, unfortunately, he didn't diversify at the time, but it got so bad that he had to do something that you and I would be very depressed to do.
Sucking dick.
Well, no, it didn't go that extreme.
Oh.
Did you know the captain's name, by the way, who basically was captain when the Exxon Valdez sunk?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the name?
I forgot what's the name.
Joseph Hazelwood.
Interesting.
Yes.
Hazelwood, that's a street in North Hollywood.
Yes, and we will do a whole separate podcast about how significant Ross Perot was as a third-party candidate in 1992.
Oh, you know, I'd love to do that one.
Yep, just bore the shit out of everybody listening.
No, Ross Perot, we don't want to talk about him like that.
Have some respect. The man passed away recently. Have some respect.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Years of age. Anyway, so as did you Elise. Were saying, sir.
So he had to sell his copy of Fantastic Four number one and other precious comics from his private collection to keep the cash flowing.
That hurts.
And you know he wasn't getting top dollar for those.
Well, of course. Anytime you have to liquidate that quickly, you're not going to get top dollar, unfortunately.
No, because people can see the twinkle of desperation in your eyes.
And yeah, exactly. And around the same time this was happening, you know, the poor man's wife passed away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just one thing after another. And then he tried one last thing. He tried to bring CrossGen to the Asian markets. He tried to seal a deal with a Chinese company, and it just didn't work out. Mm. And unfortunately, ultimately, in 2004, he had to meet with the staff to tell him, hey, you know what, you know, this just isn't going to work out. And to add further insult to injury, Disney was looking at the movie rights to one of the titles, Ruse. Ruse.
That was actually, I believe that was written by Mark Waid, if I'm correct. And Ruse was a Sherlock Holmes style story with a sidekick that was like a lady. And it was actually much more humorous than I would say a regular Sherlock Holmes story that you would read. It was quite very much enjoyable. And Mr. Waid, I commend you on that because I did very much enjoy your run on that for as, you know, long and short as it really was. It was very much enjoyable.
Yeah. And like I said, to add to the final nail in the coffin, the IP rights were sold during the bankruptcy of the company.
Ouch.
$1 million. And as this article I'm looking at here is about 4,000 times less than it would have paid for Marvel 5 years later in 2009. Wow. So pennies for the dollar, that company was taken out or taken over, I should say.
Didn't he also blame Steven Spielberg?
Yes, there was. He did blame Steven Spielberg.
He said that he was waiting. They were waiting on them to opt. They had opted the white rights, or they were waiting to opt the rights for a few of the stories, or one of the stories. And DreamWorks was it was planned adaptations of cross-gen projects by DreamWorks, and he said that they were just dragging their feet or something. And if he had gotten that money when, you know, he needed it,
it could have helped.
It could have kept him afloat. But to me, that's like hindsight. You know, that's like woulda, coulda, shoulda.
It's a lot of speculation, too. I mean, you know, especially even as powerful as Steven Spielberg is, even he can't get everything he wants when he wants it. Okay?
Yeah, like, that's true.
It's just, it's too much speculation.
First of all, there's so much bureaucracy in the Hollywood studio system to begin with.
Yeah.
Well, in many ways, too. I mean, you know, you go on a set. If you, you know, want to do a, you're on set and you're like, oh, I want to rewrite this line here. You don't even go to the head of the studio. You
WGA.
Go above the head of the studio. Like, I mean.
Plus, you got to go through the unions, too.
There are people approving of this stuff in corporate that you'll never see.
That's right.
I mean, it's just, it's a different kind.
It's a beast. You see, animal. This is why people who love independent films, you know, you don't have to worry about answering to 20 other people just to get a simple thing done.
Yeah. And let's not sugarcoat the fact that a lot of people thought that at least he was quite abrasive. A lot of people that worked for him did not appreciate his style, which I would say teetered on a dictatorship of sorts.
The guy was, I mean, I can understand it. I don't validate it, but I can understand it. The guy's putting his own money in, and he wants
to see results.
He was clearly stressed.
Yeah, he wants to see results.
Did he even have a honeymoon period of any kind? Did he have any financial success of any kind, or was he basically like, yeah, we're holding serve, we're going maybe into the green a little bit, but we're basically bleeding money, and it didn't bleed right away. It just kept going
He was depending upon, you know, selling the rights to those, selling the movie rights and TV rights to his property. He was kind of really relying on that to get him through.
Sure.
Even before, you know, the stock crash of Pearl Systems.
Yeah, and keep in mind that, this is a company that not only had DreamWorks sniffing around, it had Zemeckis sniffing around, who was thinking about considering Route 666, one of their stories, by our boy Tony Bedard.
Tony Bedard, yeah.
Who, if anybody doesn't know this, we are huge fans of Tony Bedard.
Rebels.
Yep, and he's done a ton of other good work too.
Oh yeah, I like his Green Lantern book.
Yes, his Green Lantern book was great as well. You know, they had that. They had 15 Harvey Award nominations, which is basically the Golden Globes for comic books. You know, it was just something that, besides Robert Zemeckis, you had Lawrence Kasdan, you had Bonaventura.
Wow. Lorenzo Di Bonaventura. That's a big name, guys. So we're talking about
Kasdan, I remember.
Talking about Transformers. We're talking about a number of DreamWorks.
Kasdan, I remember, I think he produced the Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, so we were looking at, you know, a lot of things and a lot of great storylines and a lot of great titles. We had Scion. We had Meridian. We had Way of the Rat, which Way of the Rat was a Chuck Dixon story, if I recall. Was it Chuck Dixon or was it Ron Mars? I'm sorry.
I believe it was Mars.
Was it Mars?
I believe it was Mars.
Yeah, it was one of the two. It was Ron Mars. I think you're right. I think it was Ron Mars that did that one. And Ron Mars did that one, and it was just fantastic. I mean, just really fantastic. Just a really good story. Lots of really key creators and stuff behind it. This is a company that ended much too soon. And they ended up selling to Disney?
Yes. Oh, by the way, Dixon. You're right. It was Chuck Dixon.
Was it Dixon?
Yes, Chuck Dixon.
Okay.
24 issues.
Okay. All right. I thought it was Dixon. That was my go-to. That was my gut instinct. Was Dixon.
G.I. Joe?
Yeah. Ron Mars did the other one. He did the other story in there. I can't remember the name of it, though.
Oh, so they did end up selling to Disney, unlike Amazing Spider-Man. So, yeah. But no, honestly, we don't have much more to add. I mean,
it was
this
the path.
Brief.
Ron Mars wrote The Path. Dixon wrote Way of the Rat.
That's right.
I always get those two confused. But also, Ron wrote Chimera, Cross-Gen Chronicles, Mystic, Scion, and Sojourn. Run through 24 of Sojourn.
Chimera is the evil virus in Mission Impossible.
Impossible 2, yes. The John
Which
Woo
is
one.
The worst of the bunch.
And Kevin,
what...
first two, actually, are the worst of the bunch.
The mythical... Yeah. So, Kevin, the mythical creature, the Chimera, would you like to go into depth on that? I know you didn't do your research, but I know in that brain of yours, you know all about the Chimera.
It's something of a sinister creature, is it not?
It's Greek mythology. It's like it's got a lion head and a dragon body.
That's true.
Or something like that.
Something like that.
Who's keeping track? All I know is
Boy, by the way, did I tell you my idea for a Mission Impossible movie?
Mm-mm.
Like one where you connect all the movies together to one particular character that's been in all the movies and make them like the ultimate villain, but the entire time you never knew they were the villain.
Are you talking about, what's his face?
Yes.
Michael Clark Duncan's the one.
Ving Rhames. Yeah. That would be Luther Stickle.
Luther Stickle.
They always got Michael Clark Duncan and Ving Rhames confused.
Yeah, Luther Stickle.
Michael Clark Duncan even did he was on, I can't remember if it was Leno or what it was, and he just turned and he was like, I'm not Ving Rhames, everybody. I'm not Ving Rhames. Stop calling me that.
Which is
hilarious.
But what I can tell you is Michael Clark Duncan was considerably taller than
Ving Rhames. We've seen him before.
Yeah,
Ving Rhames, big dude.
He's a couple inches shorter than me. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he's a wide guy, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But I mean, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like those. The last Mission Impossible was fantastic.
Oh my God, did you see it in the IMAX?
The last three.
Did you see it in IMAX?
Well, that's true. No.
Oh my God.
Ghost Protocol. Remember we watched that Ghost Protocol at IMAX years ago?
I saw that too.
Sure, I'm going to say yes, but
I don't
remember that.
I remember, a friend of the show, I saw Ghost Protocol. And I'll tell you what, that fifth one, the name just came
from Rogue Nation.
Oh my God, that's good.
I didn't expect it was going to be much of anything. I'm like, you know what, man, this is a pretty good movie. I was very impressed. I'm like, man, this is good.
The scene at the Vienna Choir House.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Anyway, let's stick with next gen. We pretty much, you know, I feel like we've covered a lot of the information. It's just not much out there, unfortunately. It is a glimpse, in the words of Pink Floyd.
Yeah. Cross gen. It's only was around for about 5 years.
Yeah.
To be honest, but I will say it was big enough to be acquired by Disney.
Yeah. Much like
Marvel. Much like Malibu, Marvel did try to bring it back a few years ago. I think like 5 years ago, they tried to bring it back into their universe. It didn't sell. They tried Ruse and one or two other stories. I can't remember whichever ones, but they just didn't take. They weren't what they wanted them to be.
If they were smart, they should try to integrate cross-gen and Malibu characters into the the Marvel Universe, much as the same way as DC integrated the Charlton characters into there.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying, like, when we talked to the creators of Malibu, those that are listening, we did a podcast interview of the creators of Malibu. It was really good. If you get a chance to listen to it, please do. But we talked to them about that and the fact that, you know, it could have been a whole nother ball of wax should DC had acquired Malibu instead, because Malibu was originally trying to make a deal with DC first, and then Marvel stepped in and made it go very fast, and they were like, well, we want you. So they just kind of took over from there. But yeah, I think DC, when they acquire rights to characters, I think they handle them a little better than Marvel, because you see them, for starters.
You know, you think of Jim Lee's company, you know, Wildstorm.
Yeah, no shit. DC put them right in there. You know, right in there. And some of those characters are up in the mix still to this day.
And with the struggles that Marvel Comics I'm hearing are having right now with the direction they've gone, why not bring back some of these characters from the 90s and integrate them into Marvel Universe? How cool would that be if you saw Prime, if you saw Ruse, if you saw Code 6?
Honestly, we're at a time right now where guys like us are the primary purchasers of comics.
That's true. Absolutely. That's true.
We're their bread and butter. We are their life force. Mm-hmm. And we want Malibu back.
And by the way,
we want CrossGen back.
If they don't, you know, start coming to the table for those who are the hardcore collectors, you're going to suffer the same fate as one of our favorite franchises is suffering, Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also, too, we have to bear in mind, and I know this is a long ways away, and we haven't really got the full hype machine behind it yet, but Phase 4 is very concerning to me.
Oh, it is concerning to me as well.
There's
all over the board.
Something stale about it.
Yep.
You know, obviously it's like...
Five looks better. Potential for Five looks better. You know,
their Disney Plus lineup is more exciting.
That's true.
Yeah.
I actually agree with you on that.
And that's got fundamental flaws to me.
I mean, it's good and bad. I mean, I would be happy to scale back the movie cinematic world of Marvel and do more serial storytelling like we would get in a comic.
Now, the funny thing is, maybe that's Kevin Feige's actual plan. In a weird way. Maybe that is. Maybe he realizes, you know what? Actually, maybe that's not a bad idea, because you're coming off this big high from Endgame. You kind of need a break.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to just jump into another big story, so take your time. Spend the next 5 years slowly integrating the X-Men characters and the Fantastic Four characters in, as well as the other things they're doing on Disney+.
Mm-hmm.
It might work. It might work.
Oversaturation is a thing. Right. Except American Idol style shows back in the early 2000s.
Right.
Like, we're going to oversaturate the market with it. And everyone watched all of them.
They did.
All right.
But yeah, I guess that's going to be pretty much it.
Yes. If you be so kind.
One more shout out to Ruse and to Mark Waid for creating such a great... Well, he wrote it. He basically created it. Mark Alessi brought it to life. And by the way, rest in peace to Mark. I know he's, love him or hate him, the man did pass away earlier this year. So, you know, our condolences to the family and everybody that did know him and appreciated him for what he did and brought this whole universe to life.
Oh,
yeah, for 5 years he brought this universe to life. And love him or hate him, it would not have existed without him. So... Mm-hmm. A special thank you to him as well, and a rest in peace. And but with that, I think we're gonna wrap this up. Please search us on social media. Find us on Facebook, Instagram,
YouTube,
on Twitter. Reach out to us if you got questions. We have random people emailing us and saying, "Hey, how much is this book worth?" Honestly, we don't mind that. That's okay. You can email us. You can hit us up on Facebook. You can Instagram us. You can Twitter us.
You can even come over to Darren's house and he'll personally tell you.
Well, the thing too is like, we don't mind making you rich.
Right.
It doesn't cost us anything. It costs us even a pinch of time. Like the encyclopedia of comic book prices that resides in our mind, you guys have no idea.
Telling you now, for those of you out there, the books that are now hot because of the series is on Disney streaming and on Netflix and in the movie theaters, we foresaw this a while ago. And I'm not bragging. I'm just saying we've done our research. We've put in the work. We've put in the effort. And when we tell you to pick up a book, you should
take heed.
Try to pick it up, especially if it's reasonably priced. Go, oh, I need to go get it.
Take heed.
Just get it.
Before
just
it's too late. It. Before it's too late.
It's not going to go down in value. I mean, you're not going to lose out, especially right now if all this heat. This heat is hot. The prospecting world is white hot. So just listen when you can and where you can. But, you know, again, we're on, as far as our podcast, we're on
YouTube.
We're on Sprecher now.
We are on Sprecher.
Spotify.
We're on Spotify.
Obviously, we're on iTunes.
Yes, we're on iTunes, and we are on Google Play Music as well. So we have a lot of options out there for you to find us and listen to us and love us.
No excuses not to listen to this wonderful, righteous podcast.
Right. And if you can't find us, maybe we'll see you
at the comic shop.
And you most certainly will love us.
All right, no more sexy talk. You're done.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.